Do I have any relevant financial relationships? No. I wish I did. I don't. Okay. So I'm Lois Utley. I've been in the women's health movement for probably, most of my life in one form or another. But most recently, in 1997, I started a project called Merger Watch in Albany, New York, which some of you may be familiar with, that is still working hard. We've worked on more than 90 cases nationwide, protecting access to reproductive health care when religious and non-religious hospitals merge. And it was my work on that issue that alerted me to the fact that the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops was getting very interested in health reform and was likely to play a big role in the health reform debate that would play out in Washington. And as we all know, yes, they did get very involved, and yes, they did have a great big footprint on it, unfortunately. What I'm going to do this morning is talk about the battles that are going to be unfolding starting in January, and in fact they've already started to some extent in some states, as health reform implementation moves to the states. So I'm going to outline for you some of the things that are going to happen, and then some of the battles that we're going to face, and suggest a few strategies and tools that we can all use to try to protect women's access to reproductive health care and health reform. Okay, what happens next in health reform? So starting in January, states that are going to do it this at all, and remember we have about, I think it's 20 states now, that have said, we don't like health reform, we're going to sue and not implement it. But the rest of the states must begin constructing these new health insurance exchanges that are due to open in 2014. And let me say, even some of those states that say they don't want to have it are probably going to have to start doing something about this in January. As well, we're going to start seeing dramatic expansion of the Medicaid program to cover millions more people. There is actually an option in the health reform bill that allows states to do an early expansion of Medicaid. Whether any of them will be able to do it, given the fiscal circumstances of states, I don't know. But this is going to be something to watch as well. And state regulators are already getting enhanced powers over insurance companies. I want to let you know that Raising Women's Voices is out in the states on the front lines. We have regional coordinators working in all the states that are listed here, and I think we have somebody from our Pennsylvania coalition here, right, in the front row. Yay. Good work. Nationally, we're working within some important coalitions like Families USA, Universal Healthcare Action Network, Community Catalyst, to find out what these groups are doing on a national basis, and what they're thinking about, what their plans are for these state exchanges, and try to influence them. So what should we do as women's health advocates to get ready for this battle that's going to unfold starting in January? Well, the first thing we need to do is exactly what we're doing here at this very moment, which is getting ourselves up to speed and educated about what's happening. Raising Women's Voices is sponsoring sessions in a number of the states where we have state coordinators to try to educate women about the details of the health reform law and some of the issues that are going to be coming up. We'd be happy to help in your state if you want to sign up or see Cindy or Billy afterwards. Unfortunately, I'm going to have to run to another session. We as women's health advocates need to be plugged in to state-level implementation of health reform. And we're going to need some really good strategies and messaging for work in pro-choice, anti-choice, and unfortunately the increasing number of mixed and anti-choice states now as a result of the election. Let me just briefly review what is an insurance exchange. Think of it as a healthcare supermarket or Travelocity. where you can compare offerings and choose the one best for you. So if this all works out right, you would be able to go on a website, and if you don't already have health insurance, if you need to buy health insurance as an individual, you could go on a Travelocity-like website where you could type in your needs, and you could see all the different health insurance plans that are available to you. And if we get the right information, then you will be able to make a good choice for you and your family of what health insurance would work for you. And you will be eligible for federal subsidies to help you buy it. Small businesses can also go into the exchange and purchase health insurance for their employees there. And this might turn out to be a real good option for many of the small women-owned businesses around the country that are having trouble affording health insurance for their employees, as well as for nonprofits are also eligible. So that's a place where we can get health insurance. Ideally, we hope that these exchanges will be set up in such a way that you can go in the front door of it, whether it's electronically or in person, and fill out one application, which would then be looked at to see, might you be eligible for expanded Medicaid? Might your kids be eligible for the CHIP program? Or if not, are you eligible for federal subsidies? It's a very important thing that we as women's health advocates start to fight for what we're calling the no wrong door policy. What this means is you shouldn't have to be shuttled around from one place to another to figure out what you're eligible for. One eligibility application, and you should seamlessly be shunted to the right place for what you're eligible for. What are the issues for us as women's health advocates? Well, first and most importantly, will insurers be allowed to offer abortion coverage in your state's exchange? As you probably know, under the Nelson Amendment, remember Senator Ben Nelson, Nebraska? Sorry if anybody's here from Nebraska. Each state has the power to allow, prohibit, or restrict abortion coverage in the state exchange. Now you can see what opportunities that's going to open up for the anti-choice folks as we start to have these battles over the state insurance exchanges. So already 12 states have introduced bills to ban abortion coverage within the state insurance exchanges. Remember, these aren't even opening until 2014, but they've already gone ahead and passed the bill to ban abortion coverage in them. Five states have actually enacted these bans so far: Arizona, Louisiana, Mississippi, Missouri, and Tennessee. And there were two more state legislatures that passed it, but the governors vetoed it. One of those, Florida, has now got a governor who's not going to veto it. And Oklahoma, same thing. So what are we likely to face next? I have a colleague here from Pennsylvania, and I'm sure she's gritting her teeth looking at this slide. Already, anti-choice legislators in Pennsylvania have introduced a bill which didn't go anywhere this session but could take off starting in January that would restrict abortion coverage to three circumstances. Rape cases. This is going to sound familiar to those of you who know the Hyde Amendment, but it's even worse than Hyde. Rape cases where the victim personally reports the crime and identifies the assailant, if known, within 72 hours. Yeah, think about that one. Incest, if the crime is reported to authorities within 72 hours of confirmation of pregnancy. Now think about that one. You're maybe an 11-year-old girl and you've been raped by your stepfather and you become pregnant. In order to be eligible to have your insurance cover the abortion, you'd have to go report your stepfather to the authorities. Life endangerment from physical, not mental, cause. So this specifically excludes cases of likely suicide. If a woman is, totally emotionally upset about the circumstance, if maybe she has a serious mental illness, I'm showing you this in detail because we're likely to see the same bill introduced in a number of the anti-choice states, and I want to alert you to it right away. Okay, we had a pretty terrible time last week at the elections, with some exceptions. Vermont got a single-payer governor, yay. New York, we got a pro-choice governor. California, we fended off Meg Whitman. But there are a lot of states in which, unfortunately, pro-choice and pro-health reform governors are going to now switch to anti-choice or anti-health reform or both. Here are some of those states. And in addition, anti-choice and anti-reform forces increased markedly in some of the state legislatures to where both houses of the legislature in some of these states are now both anti-choice and anti-reform. So let's talk about insurance companies now. So let's say you're in a state like New York or California, where we hope the state legislature will not ban abortion coverage in the insurance exchanges. Then how do we make sure we get abortion coverage? Well, insurers are not required to offer abortion coverage, even if it is permitted in a state exchange. And as a matter of fact, the law says that at least one of the plans in a state like, say, New York, must not cover abortion. So we'll be sure to have one plan that doesn't cover it, but there's no guarantee that we'll have one plan or more that will cover it. And the health reform law specifically excluded abortion from the minimum required benefit package. What's that? Kathleen Sebelius at Health and Human Services is just beginning the process of appointing a panel of experts. She's actually asked the Institute of Medicine to do this. Don't confuse it with the prevention contraception panel. This is a different panel that's going to come up with guidelines for what's the minimum benefit package that we think these insurance plans should offer in order to make it good health insurance. Because after all, we don't want to make it just affordable. We want to make it decent health insurance as well. Well, for example, the benefit plan will include maternity coverage because Congress approved of that, although we don't know what kind of maternity coverage. Will it be comprehensive or just bare bones maternity coverage? It will include prescription drugs because that was in the bill, but we don't know if prescription drugs will include contraception. But most importantly, it cannot include abortion. And no federal subsidies may be used to pay for abortion coverage. So what would deter insurers from offering it? Remember, about 87% of private insurance plans now do include abortion. So it's customary for private insurance plans to include abortion, but we're in a whole new alternate universe here with these insurance exchanges. The insurers are going to have to process two separate premium payments from each of us to buy a plan that includes abortion coverage, one for abortion and one for everything else. And there's the administrative burden. They're required to make sure they segregate that abortion payment from the federal subsidy funds that will be coming to them if we qualify for federal subsidies. So you can see it's sort of a big headache for insurance companies. Moreover, we're likely to face anti-choice campaigns against insurers offering abortion coverage. In fact, not just likely, we're certain to face those. How can we encourage insurers to offer abortion coverage? Well, we need to try to make it as unburdensome as possible for them to do it. So a number of us have been asking HHS and state insurance commissioners to allow us to make those two payments in one instrument. By that we mean, think about your mortgage payment. Those of you who own houses and send a mortgage payment in, you use one check or one electronic payment to pay the principal and the interest. So that's the model we'd like to use for these two payments. We're going to actually have to get out there and encourage people to sign up for insurance plans that offer abortion coverage. we need to create a market for it. Remember, insurance companies are commercial entities. They're in a marketplace. They will only sell something if people want to buy it. So we have to encourage them to sell it. And, you know, I know we don't like to talk often about the cost savings of abortion, but insurers are business people, and they know darn well that an abortion is cheaper than an unplanned pregnancy with all kinds of complications, potential low birth weight babies, maternal complications. So there may be some crass economic argument that we don't want to make personally, but insurers might think of. So you got to find the right strategy for your state. In anti-choice states, we're going to need to consider alternative bills. A group of us nationally are working on some of these potential bills. For example, one that would codify the Nelson Amendment. It would essentially restate those provisions of the Nelson Amendment. It might be able to look like an anti-choice bill in a state legislature, but actually do nothing worse than what we already have from the Nelson Amendment. That's one idea. We're thinking about poison pill amendments. In other words, if you're going to ban abortion coverage, well, you're going to have to ban Viagra coverage also, or anything else we can think of. Viagra. We're going to have to consider our messaging very carefully, talking about, you know, there are real health needs, why women need abortion coverage, and we need to make that case clearly. We may want to talk about consumer ability to use their own funds to buy the coverage that they want. We may need to go to a sort of freedom of the marketplace argument in some of our more conservative states, that insurers should be able to do what they want and we shouldn't interfere with it. And in pro-choice states, we're going to need to work with our insurance commissioners to minimize the burden on insurers. I want to encourage you all to pay attention to the fine print in some of the plans that are unfolding now for these state insurance exchanges. Some of our very well-meaning progressive colleagues in health reform coalitions are pushing things that could backfire for us when it comes to abortion coverage. So, for example, a number of them are saying insurers must be told that they cannot sell a different plan outside the exchange than inside the exchange. And there are good reasons why folks are thinking of that, because if they can sell bare bones plans outside the exchange, then that's what healthy people will buy, whereas sick people will go into the exchange and buy the comprehensive ones, but then that will mean that those plans don't do well because they'll have a lot of sick people in them. The problem with that is if a state insurance exchange has banned abortion coverage, then it would be banned outside the exchange as well, right? Think that one through. So keep that in mind when you're working on this issue in your states. Information, what will consumers be able to learn about plans before making an enrollment choice? Will we be able to find out if it covers abortion? Disenrollment rules, what if we make the wrong choice? Can we get out of the plan once we're in it? And I think we also need to make sure that there are adequate provider networks in each of these plans. As we know, abortion providers are becoming kind of an endangered species, unfortunately, and we need to make sure that these plans have abortion providers within their networks. There's another big challenge ahead, abortion coverage in the Medicaid expansion. Millions more women will experience the Hyde Amendment restrictions. Can we organize them and press for change? And will we be fighting defense in states now that now fund Medicaid abortions as budget cutters look for places to trim expenses? So, I mean, even in a place like New York, where we've had Medicaid funding of abortion for many years, we also have a huge budget deficit. And I could definitely see some state legislators suggesting maybe we could cut that out in the interests of reducing the deficit. What is the opposition doing? They're claiming, erroneously, of course, that health reform represents the biggest ever allocation of taxpayer money to abortions. You've all heard that in the campaigns recently. They're trying at both the congressional and the state levels to substitute Stupak for Nelson. We've all seen the Chris Smith bill that would try to do that on the congressional level. And watch out for this one. They're trying to go beyond Stupak to bar employers from taking tax deductions for employee health insurance that covers abortions. So they're following the dollars all the way through, and we've got to also. A couple of suggestions about what to do. Reach out to your progressive allies in the states. A lot of them don't know what the abortion restrictions actually say. They don't realize that this is going to be a big fight starting in January. We need to get to them this fall, talk with them, explain what's going on so that they don't be surprised and antagonistic come January. I want to recommend that we work within these progressive coalitions. They're all deciding on their priorities for operation of the exchanges as we speak. I want to recommend that we press for inclusion of gender equity and comprehensive reproductive health coverage within coalition priorities. We've just done that in New York, where I'm on the steering committee of Healthcare for All New York. We've managed to get a set of standards for what New York's exchange should look like that includes advocating for health equity, and health equity's definition includes gender equity and specifically calls for comprehensive reproductive health care. You should know that many states have already set up advisory councils. These have at least some consumer representatives. I've managed to get to the table in New York by going through that Healthcare for New York coalition, which has a seat at the table. Obviously, we need to educate our state legislators about what's going on, because many of them are extremely confused about what the bill actually says. Put this topic on transition requests for incoming friendly governors. Build working relationships with current or incoming state insurance commissioners. In New York, we've had great success working with our insurance commissioner. As I mentioned, we have representation on the Governor's Council. In New Mexico, our coordinator convened a women's health and health reform advisory group to state legislators. Of course, that state has now switched governors, and who knows what the outcome of that is going to be. So, in conclusion, I want to recommend that you keep in touch with us, sign up for our e-alert lists, and just be on your toes out in the states, because this is, as we said, this is a whole round two of health reform, not to mention what's going to happen down in Washington, which Cindy can talk about in a minute. So thank you. Any questions about the state level work before I have to go off to the next panel? Yeah. I got to repeat the question for the recording. Why does the strategy about introducing a bill that codifies Nelson work at the state level? So we're going to need to pick the strategy for each state based on its individual political situation. So in some states, we may have folks who could be bought off, I guess I would say, or be willing to compromise on something that looks like an anti-choice bill, but really isn't. And so the codify Nelson idea would say in a state, basically allow insurers to offer abortion coverage, but restate those segregation requirements and the two-payment thing. There are actually a number of these potential alternative bills that are being worked on by members of the State Strategies Task Force, which is a group that includes state folks from the ACLU, Planned Parenthood Federation, NARAL, a lot of the national groups. We're all having conference calls like once a week to talk about, oh no, what are we gonna do in the states and how can we coordinate? In fact, we're planning to offer a webinar for state advocates sometime in early December. And if you sign up on the Raising Women's Voices list, you will get the announcement about it. And there will be people from all these different groups talking to all of their people out in the different states so that we can get all get on the same page about this. Other questions? Yeah.
Are there some downloadable slides from this website that one can use for presentation purposes? And secondly, could you comment a little bit more on, say, a pretty good pro-choice state like California? What would be threats to a state like that with this?
Okay. We can certainly put some of these up on the website. You know, the only danger there is that the antis could get a hold of it too. So if you sign up for our email list, we can, you know, make it available to you that way rather than making it available to the National Conference of Catholic Bishops as well. There are some handouts in the back that cover some of these issues. As to California, I mean, your state has already gone forward and enacted legislation establishing the basic structure for your state insurance exchange. I do think it's quite possible that you could have antis well organized in California that will start pressuring insurers not to offer it. You know, they could organize those kind of boycotts. You know how groups have in the past boycotted Disney because they allow gay groups to come and have retreats there or whatever. I could see a similar kind of thing being used where they try to pressure insurers not to offer it. Whenever an insurer does offer the coverage, the bill that each enrollee will get will have on it the two separate things. So your regular insurance payment and your abortion payment. And everybody who is in that plan, whether they wanted abortion coverage or not, has to pay for it. That's the way the law is set up. So you could have antis getting their bills for a plan that has the abortion payment in it, and then starting a campaign against what they would call the abortion tax. Can't you see that happening? Yeah. Right. So the way this bill is set up is just a roadmap for anti-choice mischief. And we've got to anticipate all those steps and think two or three steps ahead of them about how to counter this. Other questions?
Ah. I'm at the other end of the great state of New York.
Yep.
But also could be a million miles away in a certain way. Although, you know, we have a very important history in Buffalo. And we have one abortion provider primarily in private practice, and then Planned Parenthood, which just began to do abortion.
Right.
And that set up a whole other interesting thing, which we could talk about another time. But I also work at the university.
Great. So this person from Buffalo wants to know how she can get hooked up to what's going on in New York. I should tell you, if you don't know, there's another person from Buffalo right there who I met at an earlier session. If you email me through the Raising Women's Voices website, info@raisingwomensvoices.net, what I can do is hook you up with that Healthcare for All New York coalition that I'm active in. We're having our annual meeting in Albany December 2nd, and I can send you information about it. We'd like to get as many women's health activists there as possible. To reinforce the message that I've been giving that women really care about these health insurance exchanges and have a lot at stake and will be really upset if they don't cover all of our issues. Okay, I'll just take one last question and then I have to go to the other session. The woman in the back.
Hi, I'm an immigrant from
Ah,
whoa.
Yes, Nebraska has a very interesting legislation. It's called the unicameral state. And my question to you, is there hope for Nebraska? And what are things that I can be doing in support of this reparation program? In the same sentence, Planned Parenthood just opened Planned Parenthood of the Heartland in Omaha. I can tell you they have a lot of protest. As the College of Public Health on the faculty there, we supported their 75th anniversary. And we're getting a lot of pushback from constituents of Nebraska since we are a state institution.
Right.
So my question to you is, how do I get involved? How do we move the agenda forward to making sure that women in Nebraska have?
Boy, are we glad you moved to Nebraska. In fact, come see Cindy afterwards about signing you up to be a regional coordinator, maybe in Nebraska. Obviously, we got to really work hard in states like Nebraska, and it's not going to be easy. But if we don't try, we're not going to get anywhere. So I'm glad you're here, and now you know what's at stake in your state starting in January, and we'd be delighted to give you as many tips as you can and hook you up with other people from Nebraska. I'm told I got to go off to my other session now, so I'm going to turn this back to Cindy. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lois. I think a few of you may have come in after I opened the session and explained that in contrast to the program and the order with Cindy first and Lois Utley second, Lois had to go first so that she can go to another session. So I'm Cindy Pearson. I, along with Lois and Billy Avery, who will be our final speaker, am a co-founder of Raising Women's Voices for the Healthcare We Need. I also direct the National Women's Health Network. I have no financial disclosure to make because, as Lois said when we opened up, you know, the project is just squeezing every little bit of work out of the tiniest bit of money. And we, our money is through grants and a few individual contributions. And the network also receives the majority of its support through contributions from individuals and by choice does not accept any support from insurance companies or other players in the healthcare system. So I'm going to give a shorter presentation than Lois, and I believe when Billy follows her presentation will be shorter as well. We're aiming to wrap up the one-way talking for good in enough time to leave 30 minutes for discussion, because the kinds of questions, suggestions, offers, you know, that just bubbled up on that little bit with Lois is what we get from this. We're not here to impart information in one direction only. But my task was to give you our sense of how we see things on the national stage so that that part of our discussion can really dive deep as well. And Lois gave you a very detailed presentation on what can be happening in the states and the whole range from a single-payer governor to states that have already voted against abortion, they're part of a lawsuit to repeal, have had referenda with people expressing their dislike of what they think healthcare reform is. But and it's so different than some other women's health battles to have such an emphasis on the states. Realistically, if we ignore the states, women will lose. And at the same time, we cannot stop watchdogging and trying to influence federal level activity on healthcare reform. So I want to start by recognizing one thing. We have a law. We have a healthcare reform law. It's the first time we've been able to say that. It's far from perfect on many levels. Women got slapped around. But we have a law. It's the law of the land, and it's being implemented. The implementation happens through federal regulations and guidelines. So Lois mentioned one process that's just getting started is exactly what constitutes adequate insurance, new activity on the federal level. What do all insurers have to cover with no copayment or deductible required. That's a new activity on the federal level. When I wrote my abstract that maybe some of you read that inspired you to come, I thought I would take about 12 minutes to talk about those questions, what's happening in implementation of that law we got passed. But now, that's not real. That's not where we're at. Even though it's happening, that's not where we start the conversation. That's not where our brains are. That's, even though I went to a meeting about one of those questions on Friday, my brain is back in my couch, staring at the TV screen in horror, trying to wrap my brain around, what does this mean? What does this mean? And so I want to talk about that. I want to talk about that, and I'm not the best person to talk about it. I don't have the, you know, the 535 member vote count chart with me. I don't have a lot of what I'd like to have. I've been going to sessions to try to get more of it, but here is what any activist could figure out, and I get the privilege of being paid work time to try to figure some of it out. Many candidates to Congress were elected who are committed to repealing the law, defunding the law, and derailing the law. So let me just run down for you, as of today, what someone who's used to analyzing health issues from a feminist perspective thinks of the chances. Can they repeal the law? Not really likely. Not with vote, not through Congress, not through the votes. I don't think the legal challenges are likely either, but that's not my area of expertise. But they don't have the votes to repeal the law in Congress. Can they defund the law? Again, they can't defund it all. They can't just go in and say, we stop appropriations, period, end of story. No money for health care reform. Could they break it up into pieces? We're stopping appropriations for that army of IRS agents who are going to be slamming on your door if you don't have a copy of your insurance card. Yes and no. I mean, if they could get that, something like that, and that was the way they were talking about it, they might have the votes for that. But thankfully, we, the people across the country, reelected some legislators who support health reform who are mean and nasty street fighters. And they are willing to be mean and nasty inside the houses of Congress. And they are willing to play every card they've got to make people who are trying to defund a part of health reform be trapped into saying they want to defund things that people like. Now, there's a little bit of a problem here that not everyone knows enough about health reform to know what they like. But our street fighters, our people who are in inside strategy there, who are elected members, they can say, and believe you me, all of us are going to be down there telling them this is what to say. You wanted to fund what you called bureaucracy? Well, you know, over here, we call that no lifetime limits. You wanted to fund bureaucracy? Well, over here, we call that no more charging women more than men for the same thing. You wanted to fund bureaucracy? Well, we call that no more kicking out kids and refusing to cover them because they're already sick and they need coverage. So with our mean, smart, street-fighting people who got reelected and us dogging their heels and telling them that we don't want any penny to be taken away, I think we have fighting chances to keep these people who signed a pledge to vote to defend from being able to do it. But ugh, what a lot of work it's going to be. What a lot of work it's going to be. And then finally, remember I said these oppositionists who were elected said, we want to repeal the law, we want to defund the law, we want to derail the law. So how do you derail something in Washington, D.C.? You hold hearings. How do you push something too? Believe me, as an activist, I've been on that side of the administration won't do it. Let's push them. So it's the same tactic, many of the same tactics. hold hearings in Congress, institute investigations in Congress, which they have the power to, essentially use the fact of our three-part government to have the legislative oversight be used to refight the battle they lost. They lost on the votes, so now they're going to use their power as committee chairs in the House of Representatives to slow down, to harass, and to undermine. We can't stop them from doing that. Unlike the ability we have to get to our mean street fighting friends to push them to do this, we can't get to those people and say, oh, Representative Issa, don't you worry about those condoms that people are going to be getting in health reform. Just don't worry about that anymore and go think about something else. We don't have that power. It's going to happen. But we do have that law. And, you know, some of us have been so mad at the administration for enforcing laws that they ran against. Well, they ran for this law. This is the law they wanted. They have to enforce this law. And here again, we can use our power as activists to make sure that they keep working, that their enforcement, which I thought was going to be the whole part of my speech when I wrote the abstract, the guidelines, the regulations, that they keep on it. And I'm here to tell you, from the people I've been talking to, they're on it. They're tired, they're sleepy, they're working really hard. They're early, they're late, they're forgetting which the federal holidays are because they assume they need to be working, and you mean the office is closed that day? So I think there as well that the leadership in the White House and in the agencies that have to implement the law are committed to doing so. So where are the places where we as activists, we as progressive who want the best possible implementation of health care reform can make a difference? I'll just mention a couple things right now because I use so much of my time to talk about what happened as a result of the election and the threats. I want to talk more about abortion, to tell you the difference between Stupak and Nelson, to tell you what else the opponents may be trying to do. They want to not just go back and take the version of abortion restrictions that passed the House of Representatives, which was the version written by the Conference of Catholic Bishops, which said, no funding for abortion and health reform. That was modified in the Senate. We don't like that, but they want to go back to the worst position. And they want to, in this moment where they feel particularly powerful, to just get through with that annoying old requirement that they have to vote to restrict funding each and every year, because funding is through appropriations. And appropriations bills come up every year. They have introduced a bill called No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act that will take all these once every year provisions and make them permanent federal law. Period, end of story. So we've got a lot to talk about, but I just want to close on an up note here because we raised our voices. We have a law that activists have worked for some version of for over 100 years. We did that by organizing, by raising our voices, by marshaling every argument and every tactic at our disposal. And we are facing a lot of pushback, but we're still ahead of where we were because we raised our voices. And with that continued commitment through Raising Women's Voices, through the networks of people working at the state level, the local level, insider strategy, outside strategy, we can continue to move forward in this period, even though it's harder now. And Billy's going to talk about lessons learned and strategies to flesh out my upbeat feeling and message. So I'm going to step down and thank you all for and turn the podium over to Billy Avery.
Good morning. Good morning, y'all. How you doing? I'm Billy Avery, founder of the Black Women's Health Imperative and Avery Institute for Social Change, and co-founder of Raising Women's Voices, and been a women's health activist since 1974. Well, some of you were born in this room, I'm quite sure. And the fight has been long, the fight has always been hard, and I was naive enough when we got started to think that one day we'd be able to sit down. But we won't be able to sit down. Let me tell you, there is no sitting down. That this is going to be an ongoing struggle as long as racism, sexism, classism, and all of the isms you can think of exist, and how they are so ingrained in our society and in our psyches. Plenty of us will have work to do for the rest of our lives. I'm going to talk some about the lessons that we learned, and then together we can talk about some of the strategies. One of the first lessons we learned is that the Hyde Amendment should have been repealed in 1977. That was a year after it came out. And what happened is that because it affected the lives of poor women, women who were on Medicaid, our dear sisters, our white sisters, middle class sisters who made up a large part of the women's movement, the pro-choice movement, did not do anything to repeal it. And so here we are today with a Hyde Amendment for the rest of us, for everybody who's of reproductive age, who can conceive. Thank God I'm not in that number. But we're still fighting because we got sisters, we got daughters, we got grandchildren, and because it is a right. So we didn't do it then when the women's health movement was strong, powerful, in force. We let it stay. And so therefore, the night the president had to sign the executive order that codified Hyde, everybody was mad. And I'm saying he shouldn't have even had to have that. We should not have lost that footing. Because if you always work to help the least of us, you'll be helping the most of us. And we let it go. It was quite all right. I remember we had a little newspaper in Gainesville, the Gainesville Women's Health Center, called Sarge Film. And I interviewed one of the women who had gotten Medicaid funding for abortion. And I asked her, what does she think about it? And her question was this. Now, you got to go back to the 70s before we had the conditions that we step over and live with today. And she said, tell me, why does the government want hungry children in the world? Why does the government want children who don't have a home in the world? Why does the government want this? I don't understand. And I remember we tried to get her and several other women to come and speak out against it. And I went to pick them up that night. Fran Kislin came down to be our speaker. She was at Catholics for Choice at that time, just starting that organization. And none of them were home. It's real hard for people who depend on public assistance to latch out against their check. And so it was just one of those early organizers' lessons. And I don't know how brave people are today to speak out with all of the different ways that they could be cut off. One of the things that we did at Raising Women's Voices is we targeted young women. And we do have a slideshow that let young people know about all of the provisions of health care reform, about them being able to stay on their parents' insurance and what it means to them. But what we didn't do was target older women. And the older women, we didn't let them know what was not changing, what was good, and what was happening. The difference between these two populations is one of them vote when it's cool to do it. It was cool to vote for Obama. It was cool to work with them. But it was uncool to work and vote during the midterm election. Old people vote. We vote all the time because we had civics lessons. We learned what it is to be a citizen. Are they teaching civics in school anymore? I mean, people, they're not teaching geography. They don't know anything like that. And I'm amazed at the people who had not ever registered to vote. I grew up in a household, the thought never occurred to any of us in my family not to vote. That is not an option. And we got a whole generation of people who, okay, I don't have to vote. They don't even know. And so we better go with the ones who had civics and the ones who understand it. So that was a big error we made. We did not expect all the lies, the misconceptions, the dumbness, the stupidity that came out of healthcare reform. The death panels and all this very silly stuff, of which we saw endless commercials spouting it over the television. I was so glad when election day came and we didn't have to endure those horrible TV ads. We did not expect it. But what you got to remember, as one woman told me yesterday, that we have a population who the average IQ is less than 200. And so people don't think, they don't know how to think. I mean, it's a minus 200, not less than 200, a minus 200. I wonder why y'all didn't get that. I didn't deliver it right. I'm sorry, it's a minus 200. So we do have a bunch of people who know absolutely nothing. I mean, we are not a very literate population. We are a lot of dummies. And as I said, individually we are wonderful, but collectively we stink. We do no analysis, we do no thinking, we just kind of follow along, just without thinking, and follow whatever's going on. So we have to really move past that. It's also hard, we found out a lesson we learned, it's hard to raise money. And a lot of foundations, well, most of us get a, oh, I forgot to say, I have no disclosure. Nobody give me nothing. I mean, we get a lot of our money from foundations. A lot of the foundations didn't think healthcare reform was going anywhere. It was a waste of money, and their boards didn't allocate it to be a priority. So we had a hard time raising money. We were able to raise a few funds, but nothing like what we need. This is a big country, and everybody is overloaded and too busy, and the only way we could get people who are already in existing organizations to work on that was to give them a little piece of money so they could allocate staff who could work on this. And then if we found foundations like the big ones that gave out the millions of dollars, they didn't touch abortion. They weren't funding anybody who was working on abortion. So therefore, it was really hard. And liberals are such a strange bag of people. The conservative people, they will give any fool out there who want to do something, whether they are a witch or whatever, they will throw money at them like you don't believe, go do whatever you want. Liberals, you got to have this in line, and then maybe we'll give you something over here, and then we're going to give you a little bit. The dealing with the sister, I think she's gone from Planned Parenthood. We got this whole situation of all of these billboards put up by the antis all over the state. Now they've all over the southern states saying that the worst place for a child to be is in a woman's womb, accusing black women of genocide. There are billboards, do you know who Margaret Sanger is? And we, and so I said to Planned Parenthood, you don't need to be throwing, giving money to any black women's groups that's willing to speak out and work on abortion. They might not be perfect, but they're willing to take the risk to stand up and speak. No, liberals don't do that. You know, that's not the way we work. And so we're going to lose because we don't work that way. We underestimated the extent to which U.S. citizens do not believe that access to health care is a human right. To hear people say, you don't deserve to have health care, it's not a human right, and sport that with pride is disgusting. It's immoral. It really is. We also fail to think about how much consumerism has infected healthcare. That we don't want to pay, we don't want it if you don't have to pay a high price for it. That means it ain't no good. So I have really stopped using the word healthcare consumer for that fact. We are not buying and selling goods here. Say to people, what if you had to walk out of your house every day, pay to drive on your street? Would you do that? Somehow we think education, highways, and all that, sure, we pay through our taxes, but we feel that everybody deserves to have a right to go to school, deserves to be able to drive along a highway that's not full of potholes, deserves safety, deserves water that you can drink that you don't die or get bad diarrhea or whatever every time you get. These are places that we have, but not on health care. That was really a shock. We were also surprised as how far people will go to work against their own interests. They will just stand up and do things that don't benefit them. And not surprised so much by this, but look at how major corporations and how willing, really, the ruling classes absolutely manipulate the rest of us. And people go along with it. If you think about this Bush tax cut, they think it's okay for rich people to have it because one day they might be rich and they won't have the cut. Well, hello, you just wait for that day. That ain't happening. You know, and why is it there's so many of us, 99% of us, who can't understand this kind of analysis? We wish that we had had better coordination between the White House, and I'm an Obama person. Way when this man first spoke at the Democratic Convention, when he saw purple, he didn't see red and blue, he saw purple. I predicted that he would be the president that would sign health care reform. So I'm there, and part of the reason I worried about is getting elected, because I grew up in the South where we were taught in black families racial pride. And my mother taught me anything a black person did anywhere reflected on me. I still carry it. A lot of us still carry it. A lot of us wish we didn't have it. When some kind of bad thing, when Timothy McVeigh blew up the building in Oklahoma, the first question we asked, was he black? White people don't ask that question. White people don't say, well, they're white, but we do. So I knew if Obama got in, I would be worried all the time, sick. So I have had to back myself away. I actually have, because I could, you know, it's just not good for your heart, you know, so you have to put a little distance there. But we really wish there had been a lot better coordination between the pro-choice groups and the White House. I mean, he could have called people in and said, listen, I'm going to have to sign this darn president executive order. But it's not saying anything that's not already said, rather than letting people be broadside with it and find out that way. And that's something that needs to be done better. We did not do sufficient outreach to minority populations. We did some, but we did as much as we could. If we'd had more money, we could have done more. And I certainly was on top of trying to get every black activist I knew who was interested in healthcare reform. We didn't have time to go in and totally educate a whole bunch of people to get them there, or money. But we needed to reach immigrants more, other people of color. We were not able to build a real broad base on coalition that really is going to be needed moving forward. And a lesson we learned, we really wish the whole healthcare reform thing was a lot simpler. You know, easier to understand. And when I went on Medicare, you go to the website, I'm telling you, you go to the Travelocity thing, it's a good example, but honey, you have a hard time trying to figure out what to do. And there were two of us there with about 30 years of schooling between the two of us, and we could not figure it out. I had to resort to asking my friends, what did you do? And then you get this little flimsy card. That's a flimsy little piece of paper. Mine is already dog-eared so bad, I'm going to have to go have it laminated. That I talked to the APHA executive director from Canada yesterday. He showed me he got a pretty card. It's got his picture on it. It's plastic like a credit card. It's got a number on it. Just that kind of symbol, you didn't feel like his was going to go away. Like, I feel like mine is going to disintegrate at any moment. So it's going to be hard, because I was wondering, what are all the, you know, there's some older black women who I know. couldn't deal with this computer and trying to figure out how to get on Medicare. So things need to be simplified. Now, what are some of the strategies? We got to work like hell. I mean, we've got to work hard. And maybe one of our strategies should be is to keep the Republicans spinning around health care reform so they can't work on jobs and the economy as they promise. And maybe we can keep them spinning. And so maybe that kind of revenge might help get some of us motivated. You know, let's do that. We've got to start talking to women again like we did in the early days of the women's health movement. In the old days, women who had two quarters together, or girls, had $1,000 saved up because they knew that they might have to go get an abortion. And then all the girls would pool their money. This didn't happen among the black girls. This happened among the white girls. This is my friend Leslie Davidson said, did you know about the $1,000? I'd never heard of it. But they would put their money together if one in their little group had to go have an abortion. And that's the way we did it. So we got to go back to that pre-legal abortion thinking days, which is going to be hard for my young sister over here from Buffalo because she don't know nothing about that. But we got to teach them that because you got to prepare, you know. And women don't plan to have abortions. So while we were saying you're going to take out insurance, you think about, but we also don't plan to have fires. We don't plan to have floods. We don't plan to have any of these auto accidents or anything happening, but we buy insurance for it. And so abortion is not something anybody believes in. It's not something people plan for. Oh, I think I'll go get pregnant so I can go have an abortion. I mean, it doesn't go like that. But we got to have people planning for the inevitable. So folks like me got to talk to our grandkids and talk to our daughters already know it because they've grown up knowing all of this. But our grandchildren have no idea, and we have to talk to each other. We have to build broad-based coalitions. We have got to reach out and get everybody together and put all their issues together, other people of color, other progressive thinkers, and all in order to do this work. And then we got to, as I said again, I'll re-emphasize, and then I'm going to stop. We got to hang them up around this healthcare reform thing. Give them a run for their money so that they can't work on the issues. And then what will happen? We'll see if the Tea Party people will rebel against them. So those are suggestions. Thank you.
Why don't you stay up?
Okay.
I invite people to just stand up.
Okay. Cindy says for me to stay up here and invite you all to stand up and call out strategies and ask questions, et cetera. I see we got a hand here.
Yeah, I was just wondering, I mean, things are different in the 70s. There are differences. There is greater gender equity now. Men are stepping up to the plate in many situations, doing child care, doing other things. It just seems that we need a strategy that would get more men involved. This is not a women's issue. And I'm just wondering, I've been hearing all, you know, we've got to go back to our old strategies of the 70s, whatever. I think the world has changed. I'm wondering what thoughts you might have of getting men as partners right there.
I think that's a very good, the question is how do we get men involved as a part of our strategy for moving forward? I think it's very important. One of the things we, at the Black Women's Health Project, we always talk about families because this really is a family issue. And when we did the last big march on Washington, I was impressed with the number of men there. There were a ton of men. So these are conversations that we need to have, and we need to develop programs that also include men. And while we're talking, we're not talking about going back to the exact way we're doing it, but we are talking about going back to the feelings, the energy, the information sharing, and the involvement. We need to cast our net wider. And what we need is raising men's voices for the healthcare we need so that we can get what that voice is. What is it that they need that has not been articulated by us because we've never been men? You see what I'm saying? So that's a very good point.
Thank
Yes. Right. Right.
Bleeding out as a result of back alley abortions. But my daughter was born in 77, never experienced.
Right. The strategy suggested, I'm just saying it so it can be recorded, the strategy suggested is that we work with young women who have not experienced lack of access to abortion, that we tell them the stories of what it was like for women when abortion was illegal, that they learn about the Jane Collective, that they learn about all of the other ways in which women were able to provide abortions, that how midwives did abortions, et cetera, that we let them know those stories.
This is Cindy. I just want to respond in two ways. One, I think we start owning our own abortions. I had a teen abortion, nice and safe. I went on with my life. I just want to say it. My daughter will be horrified when she hears that I'm saying this because she's in the embarrassing stage of being my daughter, but I think owning our abortions, you know, is important because probably a third of us have had an abortion, and that's something for everyone to know, that this happens. You can be a good person, you can use contraception. Anyway, I'm talking to y'all who know that. The other thing I just want to say is young women are hot, they are active, they are motivated, and they are motivated about what they're experiencing. We give awards to young activists at the network. They talk about what that got them motivated. And the one I heard most recently was a young woman who saw a birth movie. Changed her life. Me, I want to cry, because birth is no better than when I started being an activist, and maybe it's worse, but that's her reality. That made her an activist. And other women, other young women tell us what they are just furious about is how much they have to pay for their contraception. It is scandalous what the companies charge now. It's a racket. These are the cheapest things in the world to make. They do almost no research to get the next brand name drug that replaces the last brand name drug. And the difference is infinitesimal, but because they can claim some difference, these young women are paying $60 a month for contraception, for contraceptive pills. See, there's not, that's enough to get you. Yeah. So, yes, I do want everyone to know that it used to be bad, that abortion, women used to really get hurt when abortion, they couldn't get safe abortion because they got abortions. Lots of us have gotten abortions. And if that's not the issue that gets you fired up, fine. There's other issues that can get you fired up.
And I want to say to black women, just this one thing, then I get to you. I just want to say to black women, I too had an abortion. And when you stand up and speak to black women, because we are deathly silent on this issue. And it was a thing that I had to deal with because, but what I came to, black women get over 50% of the abortions. That whenever I'm talking to a group of black women, I know that at least half of them in the room have had abortions. Use that to get your strength. And know that you are talking to people who have had abortion. I really wish one of the big lessons we learned, that for all of the millions of women who've gotten abortion over this last 30-some years, that we had turned them into activists, and we wouldn't have to be worried about this being taken away. Yes. Yes, your question.
Yeah, that was supposed to be in my speech, but I had to spend so much time on what are the opponents going to try to do now that they have more power. Contraception coverage, we assume, will be in the recommendations for what has to be covered to be meet the test of what's a real insurance policy now. Aside from maternity care being spelled out and abortion care being stopped, you know, maternity care has to be in, abortion care can't be in unless you affirmatively choose it. Everything else is silent. It just says, you know, medical and surgical care as needed to be determined. So we've already fought and won the fights in the states to make contraception part of standard health insurance. So we feel like that is likely to happen. Where we're really struggling, though, now is to expand up the fight we won years ago to get Medicaid to cover contraception for free for every woman and man who has Medicaid coverage for all FDA-approved methods. That free coverage, that is not something that women with upper incomes have. Now, the most upper income women can figure it out. The women who are going to be helped by health reform, the way the law envisions, the women who, you know, come to that Travelocity and fill out their info and it says, oh, this year you're on Medicaid. Oh, you got a, you know, change of circumstances. Well, this year you get a private plan with a subsidy. Those women would have lost the free coverage. And we started working before the bill was written to say, how can we expand up? How can we make sure that new coverage is as good as Medicaid on this issue? And that's where the Contraception as Prevention campaign came to be. That's not a sure thing, but we believe it could happen. And there's information on the Raising Women's Voices website, and I can talk more at the break about what we're doing to not only make it happen, but to make it happen quickly enough that people who are starting to see some benefits get this benefit, and next time it's time to vote, they recognize they've got something that's better. You know, creeping by creeping, there are people who are going to recognize, that helped me already. My kid, the one who's horribly embarrassed that I say I've had an abortion, she was about to fall off a health insurance plan as soon as she got out of school, but now she doesn't have to. I know that. A lot of parents know that. But and the parents who have kids with a pre-existing condition know that things changed. And someone who was a breast cancer patient who was worried against bumping up against the lifetime limit knows that that's changed. But the rest of people haven't yet seen very many benefits. And we want to push them to make this one go fast because it affects so many people. Yeah, sure. Yeah, and can you say where you're from also?
My name's Kimberly, I'm from Oakland, California, and just a comment about the previous point about the prevalence of abortion and how that could maybe strengthen the movement and have more of those voices. I just think it's important to also be clear that abortion is not political for every person having an abortion.
Right. We need to repeal Hyde, and seeing Hyde and other abortion funding restrictions spread through health reform has invigorated people who want to take those funding restrictions away. And we've been struggling with how to talk about it because people, like Billy said, many people feel a little self-centered about their health care, unlike the expectation that, yeah, I'm going to pay taxes and the firefighters are going to come. I'm going to pay taxes and I'll be able to drive on the road. They feel like, you know, I'm handling my own health care. If you screwed up, that's your problem. Why should my money go to help you? When it's put like that, a lot of people slide down that sort of mean-spirited road. We have to pull it back to abortion is health care. It's painful health care. It's challenging. It's for some women. It's very sad. It's an upsetting thing to have to do, in the same way that some other kinds of healthcare decisions are sad and upsetting. But like all other healthcare decisions, it's best made by the person most closely involved, and that the payment is not an issue. So we don't have the perfect way to say that yet, but we're struggling for that so that we can proudly say we support legislation that brings abortion back into the fold in healthcare. So hands went up right away, and I want to ask the gentleman who raised his hand to. Yeah.
Is there a way to quietly reach out to them? Because if the Institute of Medicine is reviewing the evidence, they should still say that abortion should be part
yes,
of
the yes.
basic package, even if
yes. Yes. Yes, and yes, and yes. So the Institute of Medicine, for those who don't know this internal DC politicking, it is a non-political body of appointed experts who have been chosen by their peers to represent the highest level of excellence in medical care. For example, there used to be either no women or almost no women. So it's one of those kind of really the real experts, right? Now there's women in it, of course. They who accept an appointment to the Institute of Medicine volunteer to serve as advisors on committees that serve for about a year at a time. Everything from what are the health effects of the BP oil spill to what kind of directions should research in women's health go in the future to what women's health services are preventive services that haven't already been identified as such. And those people then go into a public process. Their names are put out publicly. People can comment and say, that person's not really an expert or that person's not really unbiased. Believe me, Dan, the minute the names came out for the prevention panel, we were scouring to get intel. And we know a lot about each of those 15 people. Similarly, with the next panel where the people haven't yet been appointed, we're going to be doing the same thing. And, you know, I have to say the panel that was put out for the prevention discussion is good. They're really good researchers. The lead person can never be an expert in that field. They're supposed to be the objective, I look at this evidence new. They represent what public health and academic medicine represents, which is the knowledge that abortion is part of women's health services, that women get abortions whether they're legal or not, that women's health can't be supported without abortions being provided safely. So I absolutely agree with you, and thank you for bringing up that point, that we don't want to accept the political defeat as our starting point.
And there's a comment process for that panel.
Right. So there's hands from people who haven't said anything yet, and I guess I'll start with you in the orange blouse.
Thank you for this great panel, by the way, all three of you. I have a philosophical and practical comment. As a feminist since the 1960s, I think we really did ourselves a disservice to define reproductive rights I'm a midwife, so I'll just close that. And we really should have looked at the continuum of women's health.
Absolutely.
From, you know, teen all the way to elder woman. Because in the work that I do as the president of the Midwife Alliance of North America, we're seeing such infringements of our rights. We're seeing misogyny. We're seeing patriarchy. We spend the most money on maternity care of any country in the world, and we have some of the worst outcomes. We have a new designation in the CMSD of mental health for post-traumatic stress disorder from women experiencing it. Which is, you know, just a horrifying thought. So my practical comment, I know I'm getting everybody excited. My practical comment ties in with something that you said, Cindy, and something that the gentleman said, and something related to the healthcare bill. One of the things about the healthcare bill is that they're really looking to prevention. And I've heard over and over in all these sessions, let's look furthest upstream in terms of prevention. To my mind, that's preconception and conception. And 75% of the women in this country are going to have one or two or three or four children. That's the average. And so we have to tie abortion into this
right.
Of women's reproductive rights and women's healthcare.
Right.
And not just have it be this solo thing that stands over there.
Right.
As long as it's the solo thing that stands over there, it is much more vulnerable than when it's tied into the life force perspective of women's healthcare.
Can't agree with you more.
Can't
agree with you more. As a founder of a birthing center and an abortion clinic, I mean a women's health center, we always saw that we were all a part. It was a part of our life, you know, from here to here. And we struggle with the big national organizations to expand the definition of reproductive health and not be single issue focused. Because when I got ready to organize Black women, we had to talk about a lot of things. We had to talk about infant mortality. We had to talk about birthing. Most people of color look at the whole thing, and a lot of other people too. And so we tried to bring that. We said it's about child care. It's about all of these things. Let's have a broad base of which abortion is only a part of it. And so maybe people are ready to hear that now. I don't know. We go to you, and then you in the back.
Actually, think sometimes when we say it that way, the other groups take the words and then actually don't include abortion. So
that is true.
People talk about before, I still think it's important. I also spent a lot of time in Chicago up there recently, and there was an ad against the governor candidate who was very anti-abortion, Republican running, and the ad was a woman who had been raped and who had had an abortion, and she was talking to women who had been raped and would not be able to have abortions if this candidate was elected. Now, clearly that's the small group.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we mean when we say we want abortion availability. But the fact that it was a TV ad using those words,
mm-hmm.
I thought was actually unusual.
Yeah.
And that that's important, because when we use the right words and we actually push for those things, I think it allows actually what we're actually articulating to actually get there. And the other thing I think is that we have to use the fact that abortion was just, you know, like, they called that abortion when they did the amendments about the legislation. And so much else in the legislation, I want to be part of doing this in the upcoming few years, or many years that it takes, but I don't want to do it in the context of the insurance companies. I think we have an opportunity now to say that like the courts and legislation don't really decide women's health care. Women have always known that. Doctors actually provide health providers, so doctors know that. But you want them out of that picture. They don't decide men's health care quite the same way. They pick this service that women needed so much to be independent and ensure that they control their bodies. So we don't want to have the insurance companies play with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think your talk about what in fact, you know, how a serious single-payer, non-insurance-driven program would actually allow us to have a more accountable system is what we want. We see this as part of the accountability that's actually missing
mm-hmm.
from the legislation.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. Right.
Drugs,
right.
A infection.
It's up here.
And so we lost this whole women's right to control the birth. And I just think we've got to put that on the table as well, that midwives are facing a brutal attack across the country, and where the evidence that they improve without them, that needs to be on the table. So I think, you know, women's health has to be the whole spectrum.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. The misogyny is just deep, 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 deep. Yes.
Hi, I'm Kelly Nathan with the National Institute for Reproductive Health, and I just want to backtrack a little bit to what Lois said in her slide about something that we need to move forward for these battles at the state level and ensuring coverage of abortion. Are really strong messages, and I just want to let everybody know that we at the National Institute have spent the past year doing message testing, focus groups, and national polls, and come up with the messages that are most resonant to women's
Thank you.
Give us a preview?
Mm-hmm. Oh, I mean, I think what's interesting is that really the top line messages are, we've been sort of so successful nationally with this idea that if women don't have access to a safe abortion, that they will resort to unsafe or drastic measures. And that's really something that came up in our focus groups over and over, this idea that having insurance coverage really legitimizes abortion as a medical choice, as a form of health care. And so there's a lot of talk that trickles up that we weren't giving to the women, but that, and the men in our focus groups as well, because we have some men, but that they really feel like insurance coverage of abortion is a good idea because otherwise women will be forced to go to resort to unsafe measures.
I also think that there's been a lot of talk about not wanting to use the issues of rape and incest as reasons, but they are some of the reasons. I don't know if you all saw the last Oprah Winfrey show where she had 200 men who talked about being victims of incest. And so we need to push all the buttons that we can, those hidden things that we don't want to deal with. Sure, a lot of women have abortions because they don't want it. They want to finish school. They want to do other things. But there's a whole hunk of people who have it because they were raped, who had it because of incest. You get a lot more sympathy there than you do with somebody say, well, I want to finish my education. You see what I'm saying? So what we got to do, we got to start playing these kind of emotional games, because the thing that helped women get the right to abortion was the images of women in hotel rooms with coat hangers and knitting needles coming out of them, sitting in pools of blood, and people identified with the women. We have allowed the discussion to go to the fetus, and we got to put it back on the women and the situations we have. We have a flyer in the back. Tell Washington, pick up this flyer back there. Tell Washington to safeguard women's health. Don't ban abortion coverage. Yes.
Hi, I'm from New Jersey. I'm here at the public health program, but I'm a part-time law student, and I'm with Boston Reproductive Justice. And in New Jersey, we have an anti-choice governor who actually just zeroed out the family planning line in our budget.
Right.
Especially in healthcare, I feel like we were
right.
You know, none of us should judge whether another state or another set of activists did it right or wrong at a time, because we don't know every. This is your state. You're asking for how to respond to what's coming. Right, but that comes up, you know, that it's like the question of, do you tell the hard stories about women's experience needing abortion to make the case that all women should have access? So do you meet the needs of 52 out of 55 worth of clinic clients for their birth control by letting that funding go through, and do you perpetuate abortion as something separate? Abortion is carved off, you know, and it's really hard. There has to be every single kind of strategy. There has to be the mean, smart insiders fighting in the legislature, so oppose term limits. You know, I used to think term limits were great, but a lot of great people have to cycle out. So you want to keep your great people in if they can get reelected. And so you got to have those smart, nasty, wonderful street fighting insiders. You have to have a broad and unexpected coalition if you can make that happen. The woman who's now in Nebraska saying our state college, School of Public Health, said happy 75th anniversary Planned Parenthood, and now we're getting pushback from citizens who said, my tax dollars goes to you. How can you say thank you Planned Parenthood? Because that's healthcare. And we're a school of public health, and we're going to say it. So where you can get the unexpected coalition, you know, the March of Dimes went with us to talk about contraception as prevention, because they know babies are less likely to be born healthy if women who have wanted pregnancies can't space them. You know, that was an unexpected, they don't expect to see March of Dimes at our coalitions meeting, you know, when we tromp in to talk to health. So unexpected coalitions. Creative, like Billy said, you know, if there's some women in your state that want to do something wild, don't you try to talk them out of it. You let that wildness happen.
Put on the lawn, anything.
And then you are the people who'll come in and talk.
Right, whatever.
You know, we did always have an element of obstreperous,
guerrilla warfare.
Noisy, annoying activism that worked in tandem with the people who were trying to be logical.
Absolutely.
So I live right near the abortion provider in Buffalo. My niece works in her office, in their office, after hours doing cleanup, and she wrote an amazing college essay about all these intersecting things, but she's very upset with people yelling at women who come that they're going to go to hell. And it was just really beautifully crafted. But anyway, it's gotten me to think that it's about time to do our own little street activism again.
Absolutely.
Because these people are out there all the time.
Yeah.
I think people need whatever kind of counter signs we want to have, sex education for everyone.
Right.
You know, just like get all of these things that we're talking about here, because it is about when you have children, if you have children, with whom, how often, how many. You cannot be a full citizen without controlling reproduction.
Absolutely.
That's it. That's the bottom line, right? And we all know that, but people aren't talking about it that way.
Yeah.
In the college setting, the students don't know anything about their bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't know about emergency contraception. But they really don't know what it is. You know, so we're out there trying to do that. But yeah, I think street theater.
So I want to call on the woman who's in the back, because you haven't said anything yet, and. Thank you for that input. Is there anyone else who hasn't said something who wanted to contribute or our question? Okay, we want to say thank you because you've informed and enriched us, and we want to invite you all to stay connected with us in any way that we can meet your needs and you can contribute. There's sign-up information at the back and up here, and Billy and I aren't going anywhere right now. Happy to stay and continue the conversation.
If you want to become a regional coordinator and work with us,
let us know that. And we, Cindy and Lois and I are going to have a meeting this afternoon to figure out how to get some more money so that we can so that we can make things happen, you know. Thank you.
Okay, now what do I do?